The race for South Dakota's lone seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, the candidates debate. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, October 16th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the incumbent U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson debates his challenger, Cheryl Johnson. The debate was recorded live last night in SDPB's Leo P. Flynn Gallery in Sioux Falls. Topics this hour include the economy, immigration and border security, agriculture, and the role of government in the lives of South Dakotans. Each candidate outlines their priorities and makes the case for your vote. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment, the candidate debate between U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson and challenger Cheryl Johnson begins after the news.
And welcome to the 2024 U.S. House Candidate Debate. I'm SDPB's Jackie Hendry, tonight's moderator. We're broadcasting live tonight from the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. With me tonight are the two candidates for South Dakota's lone seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, Republican candidate and incumbent Dusty Johnson. Welcome.
Thanks.
And Democratic candidate Cheryl Johnson. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I'm also joined tonight by two South Dakota reporters who will ask tonight's questions. First, SDPB's politics and public policy reporter, Lee Strubinger. Welcome. And Dakota News Now anchor, Brian Allen. Welcome as well.
Thank you.
Tonight's broadcast is a partnership with Dakota News Now and South Dakota News Watch as part of the Vote South Dakota project. This collaborative also includes the South Dakota News Media Association and the South Dakota Broadcasters Association. Before we begin, a review of tonight's rules. Each candidate is allowed a one-minute opening statement. Each question is allowed a 90-second answer, a 60-second rebuttal from the other candidate, and back to the original candidate for a 30-second response. Each candidate will have 2 minutes for closing statements. Questions have been curated by SDPB and Dakota News Now journalists. Some have also been submitted by our studio audience. We drew for the order of opening statements before tonight's broadcast. Cheryl Johnson drew first. You may begin your one-minute opening statement now.
Well, thank you, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, for hosting us this evening. And Dusty, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to debate. Good evening, my fellow South Dakotans. I'm Cheryl Johnson, the South Dakota mom running for Congress. I'm a farmer's daughter who grew up in 4-H and walking beans to raise extra cash. My husband served in the military, and I raised my first daughter alone at Camp Lejeune when he was deployed during the first Gulf War. Later, we settled in Sioux Falls to raise our four daughters, and I worked at Roosevelt High School for many years, as well as running a home-based business to help with our household budget. As I've traveled across our state this summer, I've heard the same thing from Republicans, Independents, Democrats, and Libertarians. They're all fed up with politicians that don't listen to them and aren't getting anything done. They're grateful that someone like me, with my background, is willing to step up and run to represent them and not special interest.
Thank you. Congressman, your minute starts now.
Thanks to the organizers and thanks to Cheryl. Yeah, D.C. is a mess. We all know it. I'll admit it. Most days I'm pretty frustrated. We need a few more adults in the room. Now, for the last 6 years, I've been one of those adults in the room. When we've gotten important things done in D.C., from cutting $2 trillion in spending, unleashing American energy, refocusing our military away from a social agenda, and pushing back on the Chinese Communist Party, I've been in the room. That's why I've been named one of the most effective legislators in Congress. But what I want to talk about tonight is what is still left to get done. We need to pass a farm bill. We need to secure the southern border. We need to ban the Chinese Communist Party from buying American farmland. Now, I've been at the forefront of those issues, and if South Dakota hires me for another 2 years, I won't rest until we're successful. I'm looking forward to the conversation tonight. Thanks.
Brian Allen has our first question of the evening.
Congressman Johnson, good evening. A recent Gallup poll finds the economy ranking as the most important issue on the minds of voters this election. Inflation has cooled. Data from the Labor Department shows it fell to 2.4% last month, its lowest rate since 2021. But many Americans are still feeling squeezed by higher costs. So what are some specific things you believe Congress can do to help with the average voter's bottom line?
First, I would say inflation absolutely is a huge problem, Brian. In fact, we know that the average South Dakota family is paying $13,000 more a year for childcare, housing, groceries, and everything else. Now, some would have you believe that it's price gouging by the big boys that's causing that problem. Economists and the Federal Reserve have said that there is little, if any, evidence to support that claim. So let's be serious. What has triggered this hyperinflation is trillion-dollar giveaway after trillion-dollar giveaway. I voted against $13 trillion in spending in the last 4 years. Now, you want real solutions. If we want real solutions, the most important thing we could do is get back to the meat and potatoes of governance. Make sure that we are funding the needs of American society and not anything more than that. If we wanted to go beyond fiscal responsibility, I would say unlocking American energy would be an incredibly good step, as well as rolling back some of the really unneeded regulations that have been imposed by this administration on our economy. One recent nonpartisan analysis said it is costing South Dakota families, American families, an additional $1,000 a year just in complying with those Biden administration regulations. We can roll those back, and we should.
Ms. Johnson, you have 60 seconds.
Well, I do agree with Congressman Johnson on some things. I believe we do need to get our debt under control because we are paying a lot of money and interest every year on that. So that's something we can agree on. I find that a lot of people I have talked to, this is one of their biggest issues, is the economy. And while stock prices are doing great, that tends to benefit the higher wage earners, and it hasn't trickled down to the people that are, you know, working, the working families and stuff. So we need to just keep them in mind. We need to do responsible spending. We need to just make sure that, he says there isn't price gouging going on, but we've got a lot of companies that are monopolies and they're buying up other companies and then they control a lot of the prices. For example, Kroger's was just trying to buy Albertsons, a grocery store. Kroger's admitted that they had higher than average prices on their foods and that raised the prices for everything. We just need to kind of just watch our spending, I think.
Congressman, you'd have 30 seconds to respond.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at grocers, and I would agree, I get pretty uncomfortable when one big boy wants to buy up another big boy. I mean, I do think that should raise serious free market concerns. But the average profit margin for grocers in this country right now is about 1.5%. Some people may call that gouging. I call that a pretty tight margin.
Our next question from Lee Strubinger.
Ms. Johnson, the 2017 Trump Tax Cuts and Jobs Act law is set to expire next year. Proposals from both major presidential party candidates are projected to add to the national debt. Congress has less than a decade to fix Social Security before it runs short of cash. Can the country afford the cost of extending some or all of the tax cuts as Social Security's retirement trust fund could be exhausted by November of 2033?
Well, we definitely have a huge issue coming up. And one of the things that this Republican tax cut did was it added $7 trillion to our debt, which increased our interest rates. And we're currently paying about $395 billion in interest rates every year just to service the debt we have. So we do need to get that down. As far as Social Security, you know, that is something that Congress has taken money out of over the years, out of the Social Security Trust Fund, and we have to reassure senior citizens that that's going to be there for them. One thing I would like to do, I'm trying to think how to say this. We need responsible spending. We need to assure seniors that Social Security is going to be there for them. We need to make sure that I think what we need to do is let some seniors work. Right now they're getting penalized if they work. They get cut back on their Social Security. That would add more money to the economy. We also have to fix the immigration system. We're very short on jobs. Businesses are looking for workers, and the immigrants bring a lot of money into our economy. We need to fix the border situation, get them here, get them into jobs, and get them working and become taxpaying citizens. So that will help expand and grow our economy as well. We have a lot of issues, but we can't sit on our our feet and just kick the can down the road, which is what happens so often in Congress.
Congressman, 60 seconds.
If Congress doesn't do anything, they just let the tax cuts expire, I think it'll be a $4 trillion tax increase on the American people over the 10-year window. Clearly, that's not the right thing to do. Every once in a while, there's a mischaracterization of the Trump tax cuts, that they brought the corporate tax rate down so far. Let's be clear. Before the tax cuts, America had the highest effective corporate tax rate in the developed world. After the tax cuts, we were in the middle of the OECD countries. Those are the developed countries of the world. We have to care about American competitiveness. We want to make sure that this is an attractive place for people to create jobs and make investments. I agree with Cheryl. We shouldn't be punishing seniors who want to work. That is a change we can make in the tax system, and we should do it. I would say at some point, inaction guarantees insolvency of Medicare and Social Security. We shouldn't touch any benefits for people who are receiving them today. But if you're 48 years old, my age, we should be willing to talk about some changes.
30 seconds, Ms. Johnson.
Well, the corporate tax rate actually went from 35% down to 21%. That's less than what a lot of working families are paying for taxes. And I think corporations can pay at least 30%. I think we do need to move that up. One thing that was very interesting in this GOP tax cut is that they made the tax cuts for working families temporary, and they will eventually run out. But they made the tax cuts for corporations permanent, and that tells you that who they're working for, and it's the special interest.
Next question.
Congressman Johnson, according to the Migration Policy Institute, a regional approach to managing migration has shown some recent success. For example, the number of unauthorized crossings between ports of entry along the U.S.-Mexico border has plummeted since January. If reelected, would you seek to strengthen this emerging migration and asylum architecture? Or in other words, are we on the right track?
Listen, it's fine. It probably moves us in the right direction, Brian, but on its own, it's not enough. I don't know how anybody can look at 8 or 9 million people illegally entering this country in the last 4 years and say that that's okay. I think it's indefensible. It is clearly a national security problem. It is also a drug crisis. 95% of the fentanyl that enters this country enters through the southern border. I'd be interested to learn if the project you're talking about helped with drug interdiction. It's also, by the way, a humanitarian crisis. We have never seen sex trafficking numbers like this over the course of the last 4 years. Now, I've voted for stronger border security 81 times, and I'm willing to try almost anything that's got a chance of working, including the program you talked about. But I'm going to be honest with you, I don't know that anything will work as good as the Remain in Mexico policy. When President Trump put that into place, illegal border crossings fell by 85% in 6 weeks. Those families decided to stay in El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, and complete the paperwork there rather than paying the drug cartels $10,000 to take them 2,000 miles and then smuggle them across the American border. The Remain in Mexico gives us the best chance to improve national security, the drug crisis, and the humanitarian crisis.
Ms. Johnson, 60
okay.
seconds.
This border issue has been a crisis, and it's been a crisis for decades, and both parties have failed to address it. They both keep kicking the can down the road because they don't want to solve the problem. They just want to take credit for it. And that's part of the problem in Congress right now that people are so frustrated on that they aren't working together to fix a problem. My opponent said that 95% of the drugs coming in come through the border. Yes, they do, and they're often brought in by U.S. citizens. They aren't necessarily brought in by immigrants. So I'm really upset that we're constantly demonizing these immigrants, and my opponent is always fear-mongering about this crisis we have going. He's been there 6 years. He's taken 81 votes on the border. Why isn't it fixed? You know, Were those votes not worthwhile? I mean, we had to have to do something, work together, and we have to just fix the system because it's not just the people coming in. It's the fact that we need them for jobs, and we need to get them vetted faster so they can become taxpaying citizens.
30 seconds.
Facts matter. This problem was it was largely taken care of in the last administration. Again, an 85% reduction in illegal border crossings. That happened over just a 6-month period, and then they stayed low. We can make it seem like this has been a crisis month in and month out, but the reality is that policy matters, and that the policies of the last administration were clearly, clearly better than the policies of this administration.
Can you, I'm being asked for a clarification. Was that 6 weeks or 6 months when
six,
that decreased?
6 weeks. That's how amazing, that's how effective it was.
Next question.
Ms. Johnson, good evening. Recent reporting from South Dakota Newswatch shows farm revenue in the state is falling. In fact, in 1 year, it decreased by more than half a billion dollars, from $4.4 billion in 2022 to $3.8 billion in 2023. The farm bill's expired. We've seen little progress in getting a new one in place in time. What can you do in Washington to bring more stability to the farm economy?
Well, we do need to get the farm bill passed, and my opponent has been on that committee for 6 years, and it's already 2 years overdue. So we do need to sit down and come together with our differences and get that solved so the farmers know what they can depend on. We have a lot of monopolies in the farm industry, and I've been talking to farmers, and they're complaining because we have two or three companies that own the seed companies. We have just a few companies own the fertilizer companies, and they basically set the price. There's no competition. So they're telling the farmers, here's what you pay for that, take it or leave it. And then when the farmers go to sell their products, we're down to like four meat packers in the country, and they're basically saying, here's your price, take it or leave it. So the farmers are getting squeezed from all sides. We need to maybe check in some antitrust things, like with the beef packers and stuff, and just make sure that there's competition and they're offering a fair price. They also are still recovering from the fact that they lost a lot of markets during the Chinese trade war in 2017, that we lost a lot of our soybean markets. You know, we got to be careful. We have to be wary of China, but we also have to realize that they're a very important trading partner to South Dakota. And when Trump slapped on the 25% tariffs, they took their business elsewhere. They went down to South America and Brazil, and they're buying soybeans from them. And we have lost a lot of that market, probably permanently. So we need to work on opening up some new markets.
Congressman, 60 seconds.
Well, I'm a believer in the free market. The free market is many buyers and many sellers. And Cheryl's right, in the meatpacking industry, we don't have that. We have a lot of concentration. It is a source of concern for me. That's why I'm the author of the Butcher Block Act. We work with the administration to get it implemented. Its whole purpose is to build capacity outside of the big four meatpackers, and it is working. Those dollars and, frankly, some of the regulatory flexibility we've provided for smaller operations, they are absolutely working. You're right to use the word stability. I'm one of the six authors of the Farm Bill in the House. We did our job. We passed it out of the Agricultural Committee with a strong bipartisan vote. It takes two to tango. I don't understand why Democratic Chair Debbie Stabenow in the Senate hasn't scheduled a markup, why she hasn't brought forth any amendments, why she hasn't even released text of the bill. We absolutely need to get the Farm Bill done yet this year. I'm ready to work with Chair Stabenow in the Senate to get that done. The Farm Bill will give us the stability you're asking about.
30 seconds, Ms. Johnson.
Well, and this is just pretty typical. When something doesn't happen, they always blame the other party. And I think we need less of that and less working together. So instead of saying it's a Democrat's fault, this isn't getting done, you know, it's both parties. They need to work together and stop putting the blame on each other. We just, you know, they need to know about crop insurance. They need to know what crops they can plant next year. They need to know, let's see here. Yeah, they just kind of need to know, have security, like you said. You know, they need to know what they can rely on.
That's time. Next question.
Congressman, many tribal communities feel their voices are not heard in Washington. Recently, this has come to a head over crime, with the Oglala Sioux tribe declaring a state of emergency, citing a violent crime rate higher than the national average. The tribe also filed a motion to compel the U.S. government to do more to support tribal law enforcement efforts. What would you do to better serve tribes and honor the treaties they signed with the U.S. government?
First off, I would note that I worked with tribal leaders in both those efforts you mentioned. I was supportive, wrote letters, reached out to the administration, talked to House appropriators. Crime in Indian country is absolutely a problem. There's not a week that goes by that I'm not talking to a tribal leader in one of our nine tribes. Of course, I'm on Indian country on a regular basis. I've got their cell phone numbers and they've got mine. And I have to tell you, they have done an exceptionally good job of making sure that Congress understands how terrible this is. And so the appropriations bills that have passed the House, what did we do? We increased funding for tribal law enforcement by 34%. That's never been done before. And I want to put this into context. This is an environment where the Republicans in control of the House, my party, we are working to reduce discretionary spending, not for defense and not for VA, but most every other area. But even in an environment where we're cutting discretionary spending, we have a 34% increase for tribal law enforcement. That doesn't happen by accident. It happened because I went, along with tribal leaders, and we told that story to House appropriators. My Republican colleagues listened to me, and we were able to get it done.
60 seconds, okay. Ms. Johnson.
Well, I do commend Representative Johnson for his work on helping the Indian Native American reservations with their criminal problem, because as I was out talking to them this summer, that was an issue they are very concerned about. They have a lot of meth cases going on. That's one of their biggest problems. They find that there's a lot of red tape, so we need to find ways to help them cut through their red tape, and we do need to get more funding, and we need to get more Native Americans trained in criminal justice and stuff, because they feel more comfortable if there's Native Americans as their police officers than white people, because quite frankly, they don't trust us. So anything we can do, this is one area. I always say there's different ways of spending. There's investments, and then there's just wasteful spending. And an investment in security on the Indian reservations, I think, is very important. And I think we also have to note that all the missing indigenous women that are gone missing and murdered, we have to focus on that. I mean, it's like if it was my daughters, it'd be all over the news. But when it happens on the reservations, we don't hear much about it.
30 seconds, Congressman.
We do have a real problem with missing murdered indigenous women. The likelihood of a Native woman being murdered or going missing is many, many times higher than for any other ethnicity in this country. That's one of the reasons that I championed Savannah's Law in the House. We were able to get it passed out of the House. It is a powerful piece of legislation that makes sure that all of these disparate agencies are working together to try to make sure that we're trying to drive down those terrible numbers in Indian country.
Next question.
Ms. Johnson, the 2022 Dobbs decision overturned the constitutional right to abortion. That's resulting in different abortion laws from state to state, leaving the 168.5 million women in America with vastly different levels of access to the procedure. The 14th Amendment guarantees equal protection under the law. Do you believe the state-by-state patchwork approach conflicts with the Constitution?
I'm glad you asked that question, because this is one of the reasons I'm running. I have got four daughters. Years ago, I had a pregnancy. In my fourth month, I went in. I was excited to find out if I was having a girl or a boy, and I got the devastating news that my pregnancy was a malformed fetus, that there was no way it was going to survive, and so I had to have a D&C. In the laws we have across our nation, abortion bans don't cover that. I would have been forced to carry it to term. If that happens to my daughters, they could be forced to carry it to term. When my opponent had made a comment in an interview that he said when the left reacted like the world was ending due to the Dobbs decision, he was frankly taken aback. Well, he's clearly out of touch with people, because it's not just the left that were upset about this. This affected all women. It's not just a talking point to us. This is our lives. I got a call from one of my daughters in the hospital. She had just lost her first child through a miscarriage. And she was there because an ambulance had to take her back, because the day before she had been turned away for care. Women are put in danger with these abortion bans. And I don't think a state-to-state patchwork is the right way to do it, because I don't think it's anybody's right to make that decision other than the woman's. And we need a national, we need to restore Roe versus Wade across the nation, so that no matter what state you live in, you are protected and have the right to make your own decisions, and you keep government out of it.
60 seconds, Congressman.
This is a deeply emotional issue. And I understand that the existing law may not hit the center of the target with regard to miscarriages, with regard to children in the womb that are not viable. Unfortunately, my family's had some situations, had some experience with those situations as well. And so I'm willing to work with anybody. I'll work with Cheryl. I'll work with anybody to make sure that our existing law does a better job of accounting for those situations. But I got to tell you, Amendment G is on the ballot here in 3 weeks. And Amendment G does not do that. Amendment G is extreme. It goes far further than that. It wipes away all of the protections in the first trimester, all of the protections for women in the law, all of the protections for children in the law. It wipes away parental notification. A 14-year-old can have an abortion and her parents wouldn't even know about it. We can talk about the Constitution, but the reality is the Constitution doesn't mention abortion once. The 10th Amendment says that all powers not explicitly given to the federal government are reserved for the states. And so we can talk about the Constitution, but let's not forget the 10th Amendment. And by the way, why would we want nine people in robes making this decision rather than South Dakotans?
Ms. Johnson, 30 seconds.
Okay. Amendment G just returns Roe versus Wade to South Dakota. It does not, it's not extreme. It does not allow it allows third-term abortions, but we have never had third-term abortions. In South Dakota, there have been zero third-term abortions in 50 years because doctors here deliver the babies. If they can't survive, they go to hospice. If they have a chance of surviving, they go to the NIC unit. People in robes shouldn't make these decisions. States shouldn't make these decisions. Decisions for an abortion is a private decision between a woman and her doctor, and that's how it should stay.
Next question.
Congressman Johnson, the Republican majority in the U.S. House has faced instability. The ousting of Kevin McCarthy as Speaker led to weeks of uncertainty and political infighting to find his replacement. When you look at the numbers in 2023, Congress only passed 27 bills total. How will you be part of the solution that gets the U.S. House back on track?
I have been part of the solution that has tried to keep the U.S. House on track. That's why Politico, The Hill, Bloomberg have all mentioned that I'm one of the guys behind the scenes who's actually working to usher in the successful legislative packages we have passed. Now, I would mention, I get it, we don't want to just blame one side or the other, but if we're going to solve a problem, Brian, we do have to accurately diagnose it. There have been 500 bills that have passed the United States House, most of them on a bipartisan basis, that have gone to the Senate, and they just lie there. And Chuck Schumer, I'm not blaming a party. I'm not even blaming I won't even blame a chamber. I'll say Leader Schumer refuses to put those 500 bills on the floor. If he would even put half of them up, the 118th Congress, the two-year period that we're in, would have exceeded the historical averages for the number of bills we passed. I would also note that a bill passing is not necessarily a success. There are instances where we have plenty of regulation already out there. Yes, we have had kind of a raucous time in the U.S. House, but that's why it's that much more important that we send somebody back who's been a part of the solution rather than a part of the problem.
Well, this is one of the problems in Congress, is both parties are more interested in power and they do power plays. I think if a bill passes the committee, it should be brought to the floor. I don't think any leaders of either the Senate or the House should be able to keep it off. That just is too much power in the hands of just a few people. For example, they had a bill that would have a bipartisan bill to fix the border and do a lot of good things about it, and yet the House refused to even bring it up. And I would like to ask my opponent where he was. Where were you and your problem-solving caucus to get him to bring that to the floor and vote on it? You could have made amendments, but instead the politicians are more worried about who gets the credit for something than getting it done. We've got a lot of old rules in Congress that need to be changed. We need to take some of the power out of some of the hands of some of these leaders and just say, you know what, if a bill is good enough to get through a committee, it should be voted on in Congress, up or down.
30 seconds, Congressman.
The Senate bill never got to the House. It wasn't able to break the filibuster. It never got through the Senate. So the idea that the House has to pick up the failed acts of the Senate is an argument I've never heard before. I would say this. James Lankford, the Republican architect of that border bill in the Senate, he's a good man. He's a good American. But that bill was a turkey. It didn't solve the asylum problem. It didn't solve the catch and release problem. It did not put into place Remain in Mexico. He's a good guy who made a good effort, but that thing did not solve the border problem.
Next question.
Ms. Johnson, according to the John Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, in 2022, over 48,000 died in the United States as a result of gun violence. When you break it down, that is one gun-related death every 11 minutes. The National Institute for Healthcare Management says between 2010 and 2020, the number of deaths attributed to gun violence increased by 43%. Thoughts and prayers aren't working. So what needs to be done to address this problem?
This is a very touchy situation, especially here in South Dakota, because we have a lot of very strong Second Amendment people. I myself support the Second Amendment. My husband is a hunter. He's a former military person. And most South Dakotans are responsible gun owners. Unfortunately, there's a lot in our country that are not. And we've made it too easy to get guns. We need to have background checks. We need to just make sure people are trained to use guns. They fall into the hands of people way too easily. Here in Sioux Falls over the last few days, we've had some gun deaths. And I just think there's too many people are carrying guns around when they don't necessarily need to. We can do a lot as far as like training. We need to educate children at an early age. I know a lot of people I've talked to are opposed to the military style weapons. I don't think we should ban them, but I would be okay if we regulated them to shooting ranges, farms, and that people had to be trained to use them. I don't think they should fall into just anybody's hands, and I certainly don't think people should be carrying them around Main Street. Upping security in schools is not the answer. And if the people that are the pro-gun people have better solutions, I would like to hear from them, because they always say a good guy with a gun is needed to take out a bad guy with a gun. What happened in Uvalde? That didn't help. The police were afraid to go in and help him because the shooter had such high firepower, the police were afraid of him. So we do have to do something, and we have to do something fast because our children are losing faith in us.
60 seconds.
Anytime somebody tries to restrict the gun rights of law-abiding citizens, they tell us, oh, this will save lives. We have not seen that in the data. A few years ago, President Biden signed a piece of gun control legislation. Do any of us really think that has changed the trajectory of this violence? Our country's not doing well. We had 150,000 deaths by suicide or drug overdose last year. Also the year before that. At some point, we need a comprehensive reinvestment in behavioral health. People are not doing well, and we can chase the weapons, we can chase the equipment around, we can talk about training, but until we make sure that people don't want to hurt themselves or others, we're going to continue to see these terrible headlines. As a father, I hate reading them. Now, I had a bill with Kim Schreier, a Democrat, that would have transformed this space. We could not get a vote on the House floor.
30 seconds, Ms. Johnson.
Well, I just want to remind people that guns are not toys, and I think we glamorize it too much in today's society. Unfortunately, I lost a family member to gun suicide, and in his suicide note, he made a comment about he couldn't believe how easy it was to get a gun. I just think that we need to maybe have a waiting period on it. People aren't going to like that, but you know what? Maybe that would prevent a lot of people with the instinct to just commit suicide fast. Maybe it would delay that. We also need to regulate ghost guns. We get guns too easily on the internet and places like that, and you aren't having the background checks. They fall into the hands of illegal immigrants. So.
Next question.
Congressman Johnson. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services says this year 45 million Americans have health insurance thanks to the Affordable Care Act, the highest number since the ACA went into effect in 2014. Republican efforts to do away with the ACA have failed. Former President Donald Trump says if he's elected, he will do away with the ACA, but that he only has concepts of a plan in terms of what might replace it. Do you support keeping the ACA on the books? If not, what should replace it?
I don't think the ACA has been a huge success. We frankly have not bent the cost curves of healthcare. It's still the single expense most likely to break the back of a family because of emergency. Listen, it's a bad day when you need new tires, your transmission goes out. It's a bad day if your roof breaks at home. But almost nothing can impact people like healthcare debt, like medical debt. And the reality is the ACA just didn't do anything on that front. And so it provided a coverage solution to an affordability crisis. Now, the ACA is not going away. We're not going to have 60 votes in the Senate to discard that. And so I think if we accept that as a given, which I don't like, but let's accept that as a given, I think we do need to be innovative in working with medical providers, in working with communities, to imagine a more, how do we move past the fee-for-service model? Do that in a much more aggressive way. We've been talking about it for 30 years, and we've barely made any progress. Wellness is also a clear area. Americans are not all that healthy. And listen, you know, I'm not a big guy, but I don't eat right either. Skinny guys have heart attacks, too. I think most Americans probably need to do a better job of managing their wellness. There are programs that we can put into place that will help them be healthier and help them reduce their health care costs. That's a win for everyone.
60 seconds, Ms. Johnson.
Well, the fact that he doesn't think the Affordable Care Act has been that important to people just shows he's not out talking to the regular people. When I have been out crossing the state this summer, health care issues are the number one issue I hear about. The cost that it's too expensive to pay. And I've talked to a lot of farmers that the Affordable Care Act has saved them because they have a somewhat affordable way to get health insurance that they didn't have before. Now, we have a lot of things we can do to healthcare, to help the healthcare industry. We need to streamline it. I think it'd be great if we could get one set form for all the insurance companies. It would just streamline and you could compare costs to everybody else. One of the things, too, is we have to check with the pharmaceutical companies. They are paying very little in taxes. They're charging the U.S. a lot more for drugs than they are other countries, and that needs to stop because the U.S., we subsidize Medicare and Medicaid. We buy from these. That makes our tax rates go up. That makes the cost of health care go up.
30 seconds.
I would observe that if the ACA was such a great thing, the number one complaint that you're hearing from South Dakotans wouldn't be health care. Clearly, what we're doing is not working if it's the number one complaint that you're hearing about. Now, I would agree, the pharmaceutical companies, listen, we've got to do something with them. I've been, I think, the number one leader in the House, the defender of the 340B program, which forces the pharmaceutical companies to treat rural hospitals properly. I think we need to do a lot more of those things because I'm certainly not a defender of big pharma.
Next question.
Ms. Johnson, in the 1980s, the U.S. experienced billion-dollar natural disasters every 4 months on average. Now the U.S. experiences two such disasters per month. These numbers from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration are adjusted for inflation. Economic losses are mounting. How would you help the nation prepare for more disasters and prevent more climate-related deaths?
Well, we need to look into the science on this. We need to do a lot more researching. Climate change is real. There's a lot of people that don't want to believe it. But we've seen just in the past week with Hurricane Helene and Milton, and the fact that it's starting to affect places in the United States that are not just coastal. We saw what happened in North Carolina, where a lot of things were wiped out. We're going to have more droughts. We've had the hottest 2 years on record these last 2 years. So we do need to do something. But America can't do it by themselves. We currently have a lot of issues. The Green New Deal has some ideas. And I will say, I don't agree with everything in the Green New Deal. I don't know about the whole paying to capture carbon. Right now, we've got farmers trying to force CO2 pipelines through, ethanol companies trying to force CO2 pipelines through farmers' lands that put the farmers and their families at danger. The farmers don't want it, but they're trying to use the excuse that it's going to help with the environment to get that through there. So I think we need to take more of a wide range and look at all the different things we can do. We can plant more trees. We can invest in our grasslands, get that better. And we need other countries to come on. We need China and India and Russia. United States and Europe can't do it on their own. So we need to work with our allies and work with our adversaries and just let them know that this is a worldwide problem and we've got to all work together to solve it.
60 seconds.
I voted against the Green New Deal because it doesn't do almost anything that it promises that it would do. In fact, it and other environmental policies of this administration force our world to get dirtier. It makes Europe more reliant on Russian natural gas as opposed to building more LNG terminals here in this country so that Europe can buy our natural gas. Natural gas, which, by the way, is 20% cleaner than Russia's natural gas. The Green New Deal puts into place requirements that these EVs have to be purchased. I don't have any problem with EVs. If you want to buy EVs, go buy EVs. But when you put into place de facto mandates, where 98% of the EV batteries come from China, you make our country more reliant on China. The environmental policies of this administration are not helping the climate. They are forcing the world to become more reliant on the world's biggest polluters. China emits more greenhouse gases than the whole developed world combined.
30 seconds.
Well, I agree with my opponent on EVs. I like electric vehicles too, but that's not always practical. That's not always practical here in South Dakota. We can't hardly make it from one side of the state to the other with one charge on the battery. What's going to happen in the winter? You know, people are hauling grains and stuff. And while it's a great concept, I mean, we can get it going in the cities, but we have to be practical. And I've never been a believer in mandates. And that's one reason I don't like some of the issues in the Green New Deal, because they force people to do things. And I think we need to educate people on why they should do things instead.
Next question.
Congressman Johnson, Congress has repeatedly failed to protect Afghans who assisted American forces in the war effort. The Afghan Adjustment Act failed to pass. The Ensuring American Security and Protecting Afghan Allies Act failed to pass. Veterans groups want to know what you will do to support our wartime allies who remain stuck in limbo, especially in a time of increased international conflict. What message does America in Action say to our allies around the world?
These Afghans who helped our armed forces were incredible human beings. They stood with our country. I applaud them for their efforts, and we absolutely need to do a better job. Now, many of them are in this country. I don't want your viewers to be led to believe that there are no visa programs that have allowed some Afghans to resettle here. Admittedly, a number were left behind through the disastrous withdrawal of this administration from Afghanistan, and we can do more to help those who are still trying to get to this country. Now, listen, I'm not going to promise to vote for every bill, because so often bills can have poison pills in them, but anytime there is a straightforward, common-sense bill that would help those Afghans who stood with, fought with, worked with our American men in uniform, I'm going to do what I can to make sure that that gets passed.
60 seconds.
We need to keep our promises. If we are in a war situation and we have local people helping our servicemen, if we leave, they are in danger. They and their families are probably going to get killed, and we owe it to them, if they have helped us, to get them out and get them to safety. I actually talked to a service member this summer about it, and he had been over in Afghanistan and was trying to get his interpreter and a couple other people out, and he was running into all sorts of roadblocks. And I directed him to Amy Klobuchar, because she has been working on this and very helpful with issues. I don't know if he ever got them over here, but I think that America's integrity and trustworthiness is on the line. If they see that we're not supporting the people that supported us, they're going to be less willing to help us in the next situation.
30 seconds, Congressman.
We've talked a little bit about immigration and visa programs tonight, and I just feel like I got to say it. It is too easy to get into this country illegally, and it's too hard to get here legally. We know that when immigration done properly, when it is done properly, it can be an unbelievable blessing to this country. When you bring hard workers, smart people, people want to build a better life, people believe in American values, that is really something special. And these Afghans who've been left behind, they are folks worthy of our assistance.
Next question.
Ms. Johnson, the Veterans Benefits Administration completed more than 1.9 million disability and compensation claims in 2023. This shattered the VBA's record of claims processing by nearly 16% over the previous year. Some veterans are concerned the pressures to process claims is causing artificial denials and a lack of accountability for individual employees who deny claims for superficial causes. So what would you do to ensure that the promises of the PAC Act reach the veterans who have earned the benefits?
Yeah, it's like we have to have their backs. If they serve our countries, when they sign up to serve, we promise them that we're going to take care of them. I was very disappointed when my opponent voted against the PACT Act, because it provided health care to people that were exposed to the burn pits and other issues. We actually were stationed at Camp Lejeune, where they had the toxic water issue. And I watched for over 30 years as veterans fought to get health care because of the water that they had been exposed to. We owe them... what is a life worth? I mean, I don't know how many people died of cancer because their claims had been turned down. We need to somehow get all of our healthcare systems simplified, maybe joint. We've got the ACA, we've got the Veterans Care, we've got Medicaid, we've got Medicare. Can't we come up with some sort of simplified system that can help everybody? But there, too, I think the veterans need to have a place where they can have their claims, like, double-checked and just make sure that they're followed through. We need maybe more case managers. And, you know, unfortunately, everything costs money. But I don't think that we should balance our budgets on the backs of our veterans.
60 seconds.
We need to do right by our veterans. And let me be very clear. I have voted for bills that would have covered every single veteran who had a service-connected disability related to toxic exposure. I voted for that bill. Now, the PACT Act didn't do just that. If it would have done that, I would have voted for it. The PACT Act also included a whole bunch of people who had disabilities that had not been proven to be connected to that kind of exposure. At the time we voted on it, I told everybody that this was going to strain the system. This was going to increase backlogs. This was going to mean that veterans who did have service-connected disabilities were not going to get the care they deserved and that we promised them. And Brian, at the heart of your question is an acknowledgement that I was right. We see backlogs at 1.5 million to process some of these disability claims. We are not doing right by those veterans because we made promises to people that did not have service-connected disabilities.
30 seconds, Ms. Johnson.
Well, I don't know why you have to have a service-connected disability or issue to get health care. Veterans are promised health care no matter what. You shouldn't have to prove how you got it. If you get lung cancer, is it because you smoked during the service or if you had some other reason? I just think veterans deserve health care. We owe it to them. They served our country, and they shouldn't have to prove how they got sick.
30-second clarification, if I could, Jackie.
Briefly, yes.
Yeah, because the system today is that if you do a career, you do 20 years, yeah, your health care is taken care of. But everybody else, the overwhelming number of veterans, do not get all of their health care taken care of by the VA. It has to have a service connection. And so I'm just talking about the system that already exists today.
It's time now for 2-minute closing statements from each candidate. We drew the order before the broadcast. Dusty Johnson drew first. You may begin.
We talked a lot of good policy tonight, so I'm going to close with 4 thank yous. First off, I want to thank the organizers, and I want to thank Cheryl. She and I have a very different vision for what the future of this country should look like. And yet, we were both serious. We were respectful. This could have devolved into a mess like so many debates do, jagged, insult hurling. This could have been a Scandinavian night fight, Johnson versus Johnson.
Yeah.
But we, I think, really gave South Dakotans the debate they deserved. And so thank you for that. Number 2, I want to thank my family. This is not always an easy journey for them. I've got my wife, Jacqueline, my 12-year-old, Owen. They were watching one of Owen's football games this evening. I've got my 19-year-old, Max. He's a freshman at South Dakota State University. I've got my 16-year-old, Benjamin, right back there in the audience. I want to thank them for being so supportive of this work that I do. Number 3, I want to thank my team. Every single day, they get up ready to work for South Dakota. Because of their hard work, we have passed into law or gotten otherwise implemented 19 bills. Because of their hard work, we every day get to go help South Dakotans. We get to be their advocates when they're fighting with the IRS or the Indian Health Service or the VA. We help thousands of South Dakotans a year because of their hard efforts. And I'm grateful to them. And finally, I want to thank South Dakotans. This is the greatest country in the history of the world. And what I do in DC, this is work worth doing. And I only get to do it because of their trust. And so I want to thank them for their trust. I want to ask them for their vote. And I'm looking forward to getting even more done in the next 2 years. Thank you.
Ms. Johnson, you have 2 minutes.
Well, as I've traveled across South Dakota, I've heard repeatedly from people from all different parties their frustrations. And it's not just about policy issues. They're just sick and tired of politicians that have made a mess of our government. And they're supposed to solve problems, but they're being more obstructionist than anything else. We know Congress is broken. Special interests and big money have corrupted our democracy. I would like to see things like term limits. I think we need to overturn Citizens United to get the big money from the corporations out. And we need transparency in PACs so we know who is paying our politicians and so who they may be beholden to. But I think it's time to get back to our founding fathers' original intention, and that was citizen legislators, ordinary people like myself who represent districts in the people's house. Our country's revolution was fought to free us from a distant ruling class. And it's not Parliament in London these days, it's Washington and Congress in Washington that's filled with career politicians on both sides of the aisle who are beholden to corporate interests and big money. So we need to send a fresh voice to Washington. I'm running as an ordinary South Dakota mom. I'll go to Congress and I'll fight for your personal freedoms, your rights as landowners, better veterans care, lower prices, and a secure border. We have a stark decision to make this election. We can keep the same old, and keep getting the same results. And we can elect somebody who has his eye on the governorship. Is he going to be focused on issues, or is he going to have his eye on the prize in 2 years? I will go to Congress as a South Dakota mom and represent each and every one of you to the best of my ability. If you don't like my work, in 2 years, I won't expect your vote again, because I'm not interested in building a career as a politician. I'm interested in building a country that we can all be proud of. I thank you, and I appreciate your vote in November. And if you want to find out more about me, you can go to SD Mom for Congress.
That is our time for the evening. I want to extend a thank you to both of our candidates for their participation, as well as our panel of journalists and the studio audience. Again, tonight's broadcast is a partnership with Dakota News Now and South Dakota News Watch as part of the Vote South Dakota Project. This collaborative also includes the South Dakota News Media Association and the South Dakota Broadcasters Association. You can find more information at votesouthdakota.com. And a reminder that absentee voting is open now in South Dakota. The deadline to update voter registration for the next election is October 21st, and Election Day is November 5th. On behalf of all of us here at SDPB, thank you and good night.